Good evening. Hello and welcome back. It's certainly been a while. But as of tonight, we are back in full swing, I assure you. And as the world is in complete chaos right now, how could we possibly not return right now? So over the months since our last episode, a lot has happened. Race riots have erupted across the Western world. A deadly pandemic has swept across the globe, killing almost a million people, in case you weren't aware. Over 200 wildfires have swept across Australia, engulfing almost the entire country in deadly flames. Basketball superstar Kobe Bryant was killed in a helicopter crash. The President of the United States was impeached. The United Kingdom left the European Union. Justin Bieber announced he has Lyme disease, and the Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy under the weight of many sexual abuse lawsuits. 2020 has been a wild ride, huh? But while all that's been going on, we've been working on a few things too, so we haven't been sat on our laurels, I can assure you. Firstly, we were lucky enough to be invited along to a series of investigations into various phenomena at the start of the year, details of which will be with you very, very soon. And we'll be sharing some very special upcoming episodes, so be sure to stay with us for those. We've also been busy putting together a live show, which we hope to take out on the road very soon. We're testing that live show in front of a live audience soon, lockdown permitting, of course. And, all going well, we'll be hitting a theatre in your town sometime over the next 18 months, obviously pandemic allowing. The show will be what we do on the podcast in a sense, but live in front of an audience with videos, photographs, stories, and the really dark stuff that the mainstream media don't like to tell you about. We cannot wait for these shows, and more importantly, we cannot wait to get out there and meet all of you guys. So, also, and for everyone who's been messaging us over the last few months and asking about our merch, well, for those of you who follow us on Instagram, you'll remember that back in February, we previewed some awesome merchandise designs that we've been working on. Well, the original plan was that we were going to drop an online shop and release all of our merch back in March, but the global pandemic hit, so we decided to put that on hold just for now. But for all you guys who are still super eager and super excited to get your hands on some super awesome merch, we'll be dropping them soon, Scouts Honor. So keep your eyes peeled, and what we'll do, we'll drop them on our socials with an announcement when we're finally ready to put them on sale. So yeah, once some normality resumes, you can get your hands on some. Thank you all so much for your patience and continued support, and most importantly, for sticking with us while we have transitioned and continue to transition through these uncertain times. You know, someone said to me a few days ago that 2020 is the wildest year that they can remember in their lifetime, and we still have 3 months left of it to go. Well, do you know what? Ain't that the truth? Finally, before we get into tonight's episode, I just want to remind you all that we're on social media. Go and follow us over on Instagram at dead_souls_podcast. We love to post stories and true dark history info and things like that, as well as drop updates on new episodes. Additionally, we've just launched a discussion group over on Facebook where we discuss recent episodes, share research and evidence, and plan future episodes too. As our name suggests, we are very focused on this being a club and all our research being a collaborative effort, and we are expanding on that going forward. So if you head on over to our website, which is at www.deadsoulsocialclub.com, and click on forum at the top of the page, you can join our discussion group there. Everyone is welcome, and we would love to have you aboard. So from this episode onwards, we're becoming a deep dive and detailed monthly, heavily researched episode format. That's a tongue twister. That means the episodes will be a lot longer than they were previously, and they will drop on the first Sunday of each and every month, with the exception of two-parters, and for those, the second part will drop a week after the first part. So, effectively, this is a relaunch, if you will, of Dead Souls Social Club. So, tonight's episode is part one of a two-part piece. The second part will drop on Saturday, September the 19th, so just 6 days from now. The subject of tonight's episode is something that's close to my heart in that I've been researching it now for a number of years, and tonight's episode is one that I've been looking to drop for a number of months. So I genuinely hope that you take a lot from it and that you enjoy it. Anyway, so now and for forevermore, let's get on with the show. Disclaimer. The information provided in this episode is drawn from corroborated and confirmed factual evidence and contains only information that can be substantiated by those involved with the incidents mentioned therein or officially verified accounts. We are aware that there are many who have conducted their own research into this subject and may feel they have found anterior details or evidence surrounding this case. However, we at Dead Soul Social Club firmly believe that conjecture and speculation without firm scientific or provable evidence can harm a case or the reputations of those involved going forward. So we stick to only what can be considered solid, provable evidence and factual, corroborated information. Please stay tuned until the end of this episode for information regarding our sources and research documents. Thank you. This is Manson and the Family.
For always is always forever, 'cause one is one is one. Look inside yourself for your father. All is none, one is one. It's time to call time from behind you. The illusion has been just a dream. The valley of death and I'll find you. Now is when on a sunshine beam. So bring only your perfection. There must surely be no cold, pain, fear, no hunger. You can't see, you can't see, you can't see.
To both its profit and enduring loss, there is probably no city in human history that has been more promiscuously imagined than Los Angeles, the City of Angels. For the better part of the last 100 years, most of the planet's population has seen a version of LA depicted in film and on television as a windblown dream of palm trees swaying, Pacific sea air gently blowing a lucid dream, and of sun and surf. A blue-skied Neverland of beauty, youth and pleasure, the American dream of fame and fortune contrasts abruptly with a secret and sleazy underbelly of corruption and sin. Back in the summer of 1969, where our story tonight takes place, this description of Los Angeles was equally as true as of today, maybe more so. The city has seen a lot of changes in the 1960s, as had the entirety of the United States of America. Just years earlier, in 1965, the Watts riots had erupted in protest of police brutality towards black minorities in Los Angeles. And that same brutality by police also affected the Longhairs, as they were called at the time, or hippies who congregated on the Sunset Strip. In 1966, they protested about a police curfew on those who were under 21 years of age. The youth revolted. The hippies were a wave that the police at the time couldn't reverse, however, and by 1967, the Summer of Love occurred in California, and hundreds of thousands of hippies from all over America descended on the Sunshine State. In 68, in the very same city, the liberal and hoped-for savior of the youth senator, Bobby Kennedy, was gunned down and killed after winning the California primary only minutes before. These were tumultuous times. The civil rights movement was in full swing. The Vietnam War raged on, which would eventually claim nearly 58,000 young American lives. Young American men who were being drafted from the same pool that fought for peace and love across the nation. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., a prominent figure in the civil rights movement, was also assassinated just 2 months before Bobby Kennedy, which also added fuel to the racial fire that was burning widely in the country. Some remember the 60s fondly as a time of peace and love, while some look back at the turmoil within society and politics. They remember the protests, the fire, and the emotion. All while just up the coast in San Francisco, a masked man murdered young lovers and taunted the police, referring to himself as the Zodiac. But tonight I'm here to talk about different murders. Hippies, sure, but ones not so hell-bent on spreading peace and love, but nevertheless impacting society and culture in a profound way, even going as far as some will say ending the 60s with a bullet. But first, who was Charles Manson? Well, much has been written about Charles Manson over the years. He has been labelled a criminal mastermind, a cult leader, a murderer, a thief, a rapist, a sadist, the devil incarnate, a con man, and a multitude of other astonishing legends. Was he all of these? Was he none of these? I think there's likely evidence for some, but as with any other legend, some claims might be too fantastic for reality. Then again, or are they? Manson was born Charles Miles Maddox on November the 12th, 1934 in Cincinnati, Ohio. He was born to Kathleen Maddox. Kathleen was a 16-year-old girl who was both an alcoholic and a prostitute. Charles never knew his father, who was a con man by the name of Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr. Colonel convinced Kathleen that he was in the army, but in fact Colonel was just his first name, and he actually worked intermittently at several local mills. When he wasn't conning people, of course. He abandoned Kathleen when she told him that she was pregnant with Charles. Kathleen later married a man named William Manson, but the marriage ended quickly, although Charles would take his last name. At a young age, Charles played truant and committed petty theft while his mother was busy with male customers and drinking alcohol. At age 9, Charles set his school on fire. By age 12, Charles was placed in a boys' school for delinquents that was run by Catholic priests. Rejected in his attempts to return to his mother, Manson spent his teen years in and out of boys' reformatories and delinquent homes. While serving time at Indiana Boys' School in the late 1940s, Charles was repeatedly raped by other male inmates, who were encouraged to do so by one of the staff members. He would also undergo severe beatings by the staff, experience which would significantly affect his psychological makeup. It's worth noting at this time that his IQ was assessed by psychological professionals as being well above the national average. In 1951, Charles was old enough to be transferred to adult prison, and between then and 1967, he spent much of his time in and out of prison on auto theft charges, attempting to cash a fraudulent US Treasury check, and felony pandering charges after he married a sex worker and became a pimp. It's important to stress that Manson wasn't a product of 60s counterculture. He was a master manipulator of it and within it. During this 16-year period, Manson carefully studied religion as a tool of control and manipulation. The Process Church and Scientology, along with social engineering, he also sought the advice of other career criminals, including pimps, who taught him techniques for successfully coercing and breaking down the resistance of women under his control. The rumours of Manson having an above-average IQ are true, with him being almost 15 points higher than the national average in the 1960s, even though he was illiterate at the time. In March 1967, Manson was released from prison in Terminal Island, Los Angeles. He begged to be allowed to stay inside, but his request was declined. His former cellmate between 1961 to 1967, Thomas A. Phillips, recalled that Manson was a comedy figure in prison then. People made fun of him and made jokes about him, but occasionally he would say something that made you think, wow, that's quite profound. Upon his release from prison, Manson headed to San Francisco and into an apartment in Berkeley with the help of a prison friend. While in prison, Alvin Karpis, a convicted burglar, had taught Manson how to play the guitar. Those who are familiar with the lore of Bonnie and Clyde may be familiar with the name Alvin Karpis. Manson utilized this to try and earn money and performed on the streets alongside panhandling and begging. Manson would soon meet 23-year-old Mary Bruner, who was working as a library assistant at the University of California, and he moved in with her. He would eventually overcome her resistance to other women joining in the relationship, and soon they were sharing Bruner's apartment with 18 other women. Manson, using his techniques that he learned in prison, would eventually break down Bruner's resistance. Bruner would also give birth to a son by Manson after less than a year in each other's company. Manson soon established himself as a self-proclaimed guru while in San Francisco. It was during the Summer of Love in 1967, in the heart of the Free Love movement in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, that Manson perfected his philosophy, one that he borrowed heavily from the previously mentioned Satanic Process Church of the Final Judgment, a movement that was created in the United Kingdom by two ex-Scientologists who brought their church and beliefs to the United States in 1966. The church's followers believed that Satan would become reconciled to Christ, and they would come together at the end of the world to judge humanity. Manson utilized this belief and convinced his followers of it, and also that they were the reincarnation of the original Christians, and that he was the Son of Man, Christ reborn. Whilst this seems like an outlandish claim and almost farcical to actually believe, ex-Manson family members Catherine Shea and Diane Lake both later said that Manson achieved his cons with subtlety. He never outright made the claims, but planted them with word games and analogy, with the assistance, of course, of marijuana, mescaline, opium, psilocybin, hashish, lysergic, acid and diethylamide, or, as Paul Watkins, another family member, said, nothing too strong drugs-wise. Right. Manson would often administer the drugs himself, taking far less than his followers, or indeed none at all himself, further pushing his agenda on the susceptible mind of those that believed his words. Those minds, additionally, were almost exclusively those who came from broken homes or who suffered from psychological trauma or detachment from a stable family background. They all played into the hands of Manson through his shrewd conman techniques that he had become adept to while in prison. Hippie communities of the 1960s often wound up reifying the same restrictive and imbalanced gender norms that they purported to escape. They were especially damaging to young women, who often became vulnerable targets of sexual assault. The story of Manson's youngest known follower, Diane Lake, is a quintessential example. Lake's family had moved from Minnesota to California just to participate in the countercultural lifestyle. While living in a free love commune called Wavy Gravy's Hog Farm, Lake's parents allowed her to take drugs and have sex. She eventually met Manson at the age of 14 and began to follow as part of his family. With the full approval of her parents, Lake immediately began a sexual relationship with Manson. Manson, who was 34 when they met, 20 years senior to Lake. And she soon joined the family without a care in the world. She did not participate in the Manson murders, but she was living with the cult when the murders took place, and her knowledge of them and what happened afterwards made her a major witness during the Manson prosecution. Today, she argues that 60s counterculture was a cover for women like her and other Manson girls to be abused and taken advantage of. I guess by today's standards, that you would view Manson as a rapist and a paedophile, in addition to the array of other crimes he is both accused of and found guilty of. Whilst on the surface, the Manson family seems to pose all the hallmarks of a cult, and indeed many have called it that. But I believe that Manson family was more than just a cult, and Manson himself was possibly not the type of leader that the media or literature would have you believe he was. Whilst there is no question that he manipulated his followers and peddled a religious guru persona, I don't necessarily think that he believed what he preached himself. I think there is enough evidence and eyewitness testimony available to suggest that Manson didn't change all that much while in prison, and his guru persona was simply a 1969 version of the pimp and career criminal that he was before, that he always was. I think Manson was a con man, a man who pushed his beliefs for control and sex. He was one who used the free love ethos of the time to prey on a cadre of troubled, abused young women who would continue to carry out his thirst for violence even after he was in jail. Furthermore, since Manson couldn't make money from his girls having sex in a free love 1969 California, he had to get money some other way. We'll come back to this in a little bit. By early 1968, Manson and his family lived out of an old school bus which they converted and painted black. Manson had acquired the bus in San Jose while he was hitchhiking along the West Coast. Manson was picked up by Reverend Dean Morehouse, a Protestant minister. Morehouse invited Manson to a dinner at his home, and Charlie ended up staying the night. Manson and Morehouse discussed the Bible, sang religious songs, and when Charlie admired an old piano at the house, Dean told him he was welcome to have it. Morehouse told Charlie he was always welcome in his home, and Manson became a frequent visitor, taking a special interest in Dean's younger daughter, 16-year-old Ruth Ann. Manson eventually traded in the piano that Morehouse gave him for the school bus, which was for sale in Morehouse's neighborhood. When Manson left with the bus, he also took Ruth Ann with him. Initially, Morehouse was very opposed to this and pursued Manson. Manson would work his powers of persuasion on Morehouse, however, who not only let his daughter join the Manson family, but Morehouse himself, hooked on what Manson had to say, divorced his wife, quit the ministry, and also joined the Manson family in the school bus. They drove up and down the western seaboard of the United States, living the free love mantra and eating out of grocery store dumpsters. Interesting fact here. Debbie Harry, the singer of Blondie, claimed that she was offered a lift by the Manson family aboard their bus and was asked to join their group. Her claim was based on the fact that she was recording with her first band in 1968 at Capitol Records in Los Angeles, which placed her in the vicinity of the Manson family. It doesn't take much research, however, to find out that Harry's first band, The Wind in the Willows, although having their album distributed by Capitol, actually recorded the album in Century Sound in New York City, placing Harry on the other side of the country. We'll see a lot of claims made like that one of celebrities saying they knew Manson or were at places when he was. We'll also hear of other celebrities who say they knew Manson or would later deny it when they actually did. This really is a Hollywood take and tale of the bizarre. Anyway, the Manson family would ultimately focus their time in and around Los Angeles as Manson became fixated on and developed a love-hate relationship with Hollywood and dreamed of becoming a man of influence within its framework, and more importantly, through music, which he thought he had a genuine gift for. Dennis Wilson, the drummer of the Beach Boys, picked up Manson family members Patricia Krenwinkel and Ella Jo Bailey while they were hitchhiking in spring 1968. Wilson took the girls to his home at 14400 West Sunset Boulevard and engaged in sex with them both, following which he left them both in his bed while he headed to the studio with his bandmates. Wilson returned home from the recording studio in the early hours of the following morning. He was greeted in the driveway to his house by Manson and his followers. Manson had emerged from Wilson's house, at which point Wilson asked Manson if he intended to do him harm. Manson dropped to his knees and began kissing Wilson's feet. No harm would come to Wilson, Manson assured him. Wilson recognized the two girls he had previously picked up. With them were 10 others, mostly young women too, who referred to Manson as their guru Charlie. Manson would later claim that he had met Wilson in the San Francisco house of a mutual friend. Manson stated that he had gone there to buy marijuana and him and Wilson hit it off, resulting in Wilson inviting Manson to stay at his house if he was ever in Los Angeles. This is categorically incorrect, however, and is easily disproved. Manson had made the claims in his 1988 book titled Manson in His Own Words, which was authored by a gentleman by the name of Newell Emmons, from a series of meetings with Manson at San Quentin Prison and at the California Medical Facility in Vacaville. While the claims were said to be true by Emmons, Manson himself later distanced himself from those quotes in the book. We'll discuss more about that book later. Needless to say, there are multiple witnesses who all corroborate the story of Manson meeting Wilson at Wilson's home in 1968, however. Dennis Wilson is an integral part of the Manson story, and many of the flowers on the Manson tree had their root in his relationship with Wilson. Dennis Wilson would talk with Manson for hours, and they would sing together too. Wilson even paid for studio time for Manson to record songs that he had written. Wilson believed that Manson had actual talent and could succeed in the music industry, which was of course music to Manson's ears. Over time, Wilson introduced Manson to entertainment business friends and acquaintances. In fact, Manson would become on first name terms with a wide array of the music industry and Hollywood's big names of the time, although many to this day, who are of course still alive, deny that they ever met Manson. Fun fact, character actor Al Lewis, most recognized for playing Grandpa Munster in the 50s television show The Munsters, recalled that Manson was a nice guy, and he even had Manson babysit his children on a number of occasions. One of the friends in particular that Wilson introduced Manson to was a gentleman by the name of Terry Melcher. Melcher was the only child of Hollywood actress Doris Day, and was notable in the LA music history as one of the architects of the 60s California surf rock style of music. Melcher was a music producer who had worked with the Beach Boys, Pete Seeger, and the Byrds, amongst others. For a time, Melcher liked Manson and was interested in producing his music, and also in making a documentary about him. This was in late 1968, when Melcher was living at 1050 Cielo Drive, a luxury home in Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles, with his girlfriend at the time, actress Candice Bergen. Melcher was renting the property at the time from Hollywood talent manager Rudy Altobelli. Altobelli was the manager of Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn, and would stay in the guest cottage of his Cielo Drive property when he was in town, enabling him to rent the main house out for extra income. In August 1968, the lease on Wilson's home came to an end. At this point, so did the friendship between Manson and Wilson. Wilson had grown tired of the family. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in expenses from crashing Wilson's car to medical expenses and the destruction of much of Wilson's personal property. They also stole money from Wilson and used him and his bank account to fund their drug taking. Whilst residing at Wilson's house, Manson had written a song that Manson titled Cease to Exist. This is the actual recording.
Pretty girl, pretty, pretty girl. Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be. I'm your kind, oh, your kind, and I can see. Walk on, walk on. I love you, pretty girl. My life is yours, and you can have my world. Never had a lesson I ever learned. But I know we all get our turn. I love you. Never learn not to love you. Submission is a gift. Go on, give it to your brother. Love and understanding is for one another. I'm your kind. I'm your kind, I'm your brother. I never had a lesson I ever learned. But I know we all get our turn. And I love you. Never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you.
As songs from the 60s go, in this particular era, this track isn't all that bad. Wilson would later record this song with the Beach Boys, and it was featured on their album titled 2020 and renamed as Never Learn Not to Love. It was credited solely to Wilson. This had infuriated Manson, who saw it as theft. Wilson, on the other hand, saw the song as payment for all the money that Manson and his family had cost him. Manson took his family and relocated to a ranch in the Santa Susana Mountains in Chatsworth, just north of Los Angeles. Upon leaving, Manson left Wilson a single bullet as a message of his anger over the theft of the song. The ranch the family moved to was used primarily as a location for television shows. The Spahn Ranch, as it was known, named after its owner, George Spahn, was featured on shows such as Bonanza and The Lone Ranger. But by 1968, very little was being filmed there due to westerns falling out of fashion. The ranch made what little money it did by giving horse riding lessons and horse tours of the Santa Susana Mountains. As George Spahn was almost blind, he employed a small number of ranch hands to help him with the upkeep of the place and dealing with clients. George Spahn was happy for Manson and his family to live on the property, providing that they helped out, although this would eventually become just family member Lynette Fromm, who would provide sexual favors for 80-year-old George Spahn, which would become how Fromm got her nickname of Squeaky. Squeaky being the sound she made when Spahn ran his hand up between her legs. While the family lived at the Spahn Ranch, they acquired a new follower by the name of Charles Watson. Watson was from a small town in Texas called Copeville and had dropped out of college to move to Los Angeles. He quickly became known amongst the family as Tex due to his southern drawl. Watson had initially been attracted to the free love, drug-taking hippie scene of Los Angeles, and it was all of these things that attracted him to the Manson family too. Tex aspired to be Manson's second in command, and multiple family members have been quoted as saying that he would do anything for Manson. Jumping back a few steps to Terry Melcher, in January 1969, Melcher and Bergen split up. Melcher moved to Malibu, while Bergen would go on into another relationship with Hollywood producer Bert Schneider. Rudy Altobelli then decided to rent the house to newly married Hollywood couple Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. In February 1969, actress Tate and her husband Polanski moved into 1050 Cielo Drive. On March 23, 1969, Charles Manson turned up unannounced at 1050 Cielo, looking for Terry Melcher. Manson had visited Melcher at Cielo Drive in the past, so knew the residents well. Manson was met by photographer Shirok Hatami, who was at the property photographing Tate. Hatami had seen Manson approach the house through the window and intercepted him on the front porch. Hatami told Manson that the house was now the Polanski residence and that he should try the guest house in his search for Melcher, not realizing that Melcher was not the owner of the house. Sharon Tate came to the door, standing behind Hatami, but it is not known if she spoke with Manson or not at the time. After seeing that there was no one home at the guest house, Manson left. He returned later that night and spoke with the house owner, Rudy Altobelli, at the guest house, again looking for Melcher. Altobelli later recalled that he had met Manson before when Melcher lived at the house and was familiar with him. Additionally, he was certain that Manson knew that Melcher no longer lived there. Altobelli told Manson that he didn't know what Melcher's new address was, even though he did. He asked Manson not to disturb his new tenants any further. This date is notable in that the following day is March 24, 1969. Sharon Tate flew to Rome to film her next movie, a comedy with Orson Welles called 12 Plus 1. She would be gone for several months, whilst her husband Polanski was also out of the country filming his new picture, A Day at the Beach, in London, England. Sharon was 3 months pregnant at this point. Even those of you who don't know anything about vintage and classic Hollywood, you will likely know the name Sharon Tate. In 1969, she was an up-and-coming actress and new wife of the hot new director in town, Roman Polanski, and she was just 26 years old. She didn't have an extensive back catalogue of movies under her belt, just 6 in fact, but she had a lot of buzz around her in film circles. She is perhaps most well known for her role in the television series The Beverly Hillbillies and of the movies The Valley of the Dolls or The Wrecking Crew, starring Dean Martin. Tate was looking forward to motherhood and hoped that the birth of her son, who she would name Richard, would ensure Polanski would show more commitment in the relationship given his many affairs. Tate and Polanski were part of the hip Hollywood scene at the time and often hosted decadent drug-fueled parties. Their circle of Hollywood friends included Warren Beatty, Joan Collins, Mia Farrow, Jane and Peter Fonda, and also Henry Fonda, Steve McQueen, Joanna Pettit, Peter Sellers, Yul Brynner, Kirk Douglas and Danny Kaye. Musicians such as Jim Morrison, the Beach Boys and the Mamas and the Papas, as well as music producer Terry Melcher and his girlfriend Candice Bergen. Friends are quoted at the time as saying that on occasion the parties got out of control and were often welcoming of everyone and anyone. In fact, fellow actress and friend of Sharon Tate, Leslie Cannon, is quoted as saying the Polanskis were trusting to the point of recklessness and that their house was often full of strangers. Indeed, Tate considered the casual and free atmosphere to be part of the free spirit of the times and said at the time that she did not mind who came into the house and believed it to be a live and let live motto. With this knowledge, there has to be some question as to whether Tate had ever met Manson or members of his family in the past. After all, we know Manson had attended Cielo Drive in the past. Tate's list of friends and regular party guests might also indicate those in Hollywood who may have interacted with Manson and his family at the time, although no one would ever admit it. The official narrative, of course, is that Sharon Tate and Charles Manson never met. But can the official narrative, in this instance, be trusted? We'll soon come to see that not only can the official narrative, one that was painted by Assistant District Attorney Vincent Bugliosi during the trial of Charles Manson, not be relied upon, but that many instances of what Bugliosi said happened during the Tate-LaBianca murders and what led to them is actually complete fabrication. Following the trial of Manson and members of his family in 1970 and 1971, Bugliosi published a book titled Helter Skelter. It is the second biggest selling true crime book of all time, being outsold only by Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Helter Skelter is considered the most detailed and definitive account of the crimes of Manson and his family in the summer of 1969. It covers what it claims were the motives for the crimes of the Manson family, the trial, the aftermath, and all of the perpetrators. Over the years since its publication, Bugliosi has received a lot of criticism for his book. The criticism is mainly around his theories of the motives for the Manson family crimes and his methods of prosecution during the trial. One positive thing that the book does accurately document is the trial of the Manson family. As the lead prosecutor in the case, Bugliosi documented every last detail of the case, no matter how big or small. And Helter Skelter really is an unrivaled historic document of the trial. We'll discuss more on that later. Fun fact though, Vincent Bugliosi, in a rare case of coincidence, actually shared a birthday with Sharon Tate's husband, Roman Polanski. Both men were born on August 18th, with Polanski being a year older, born in 1933. So, I'm going to flip forwards and backwards a little now, forgive me. It will make greater sense in the long run in regards to the episode. Which brings us to my next section, the murders. At just after midnight on Saturday, August 9th, 1969, exactly a week after the Stonewall riots in New York, and exactly a week before Woodstock, four members of the Manson family, Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Patricia Krenwinkel, invaded the home of actress Sharon Tate and movie director Roman Polanski. In the house that night was Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant. Tate's close friends and hairdresser to the stars Jay Sebring, heiress to Folger's coffee fortune Abigail Folger, and Folger's boyfriend and best friend of Polanski, Wojciech Frykowski. Polanski was still in London at the time working on his movie and had asked Frykowski to watch over Tate in his absence. In the guest house to the rear of the property was groundskeeper William Garretson, who was 19 years old at the time. That night a friend of his, Stephen Parent, who was 18 years old, had dropped by to see Garretson in an attempt to sell him a clock radio, an item that Garretson was not interested in purchasing. Actor Steve McQueen and record producer Quincy Jones were also meant to be at Cielo Drive that night, but decided not to go, much to their luck. The Tate party had arrived back at Cielo Drive around 10 p.m, after they had eaten dinner at a restaurant by the name of El Coyote Cafe on Beverly Boulevard. The air was warm, 34 degrees Celsius, and it was the last day of a 3-day heatwave in Los Angeles. The air was still, and even a lot of Angelenos had their windows and doors wide open to allow any chance of cool air to enter their homes. The Manson family killers arrived at Cielo Drive just past midnight. Tex Watson climbed a telephone pole at the entrance to the property and cut the phone line to the house. The killers then backed their car to the bottom of the hill and walked back to the house. Cielo Drive is a small street in Benedict Canyon with only 6 houses on the street. In 1969, there were even less, with just 3 properties. 1050 is the last house at the end of the drive, and it's a dead end. It sits on the hillside overlooking Beverly Hills and West Hollywood. The killers thought that the front gate might be fitted with an alarm, so they climbed an embankment to get around the gate and entered the grounds that way. As they walked towards the house, a set of car headlights approached them. Watson ordered the women to hide in the bushes. Watson then stood in the road and ordered the driver to stop. Stephen Parent stopped his car. As previously mentioned, he had been at the property's guest house to see William Garretson, the property's young caretaker. Watson pointed his .22 caliber revolver at Parent. The youth begged Watson not to hurt him. Parent stated that he promised that he would not say anything to anyone. Watson lunged at Parent with a knife, slashing him, creating a deep wound to the palm of his hand that severed several tendons and cut through Parent's wristwatch, which was flung into the backseat of his car. Watson then shot Parent 4 times in the chest and abdomen, killing him instantly. Watson ordered the women to help push the car quietly further up the driveway. Watson ordered Kasabian in particular to head back out of the gate and keep watch while he removed the screen from a window in the main house. Kasabian walked over to Parent's car and waited. After Watson removed the screen, he entered the house through the window and let Atkins and Krenwinkel in through the front door. He whispered quietly to Atkins, waking up Frykowski whilst doing so, who was asleep on the living room couch. Without hesitation, Watson kicked Frykowski violently in the head, to which Frykowski asked, "Who are you? And what do you want?" Watson replied chillingly, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." Atkins was instructed by Watson to find the house's three other occupants with the help of Krenwinkel. They did so quickly and forced them into the living room. Watson tied Tate and Sebring together by their necks with rope which he had brought with him, throwing the rope over one of the living room ceiling beams. Sebring, perhaps foolishly, protested the rough treatment that pregnant Tate was receiving, so again and without hesitation, Watson shot Sebring, killing him. Folger, by now sobbing, gave the killers $70 from her purse, thinking money was what they wanted. Watson, meanwhile, went to work stabbing Sebring 7 times. Frykowski had his hands tied together with a towel, but he quickly managed to free himself, and he grabbed Atkins and began a struggle with her, during which Atkins stabbed his legs multiple times. Frykowski fought his way out through the front door and onto the porch, but Watson chased him down and struck him over the head with the butt of the gun. He did this several times before stabbing him repeatedly, finally shooting 2 rounds into him. Frykowski had put up one hell of a struggle and a fight. Outside, Kasabian heard horrifying sounds and screams and ran towards the house from the driveway. She whispered to Atkins loudly that someone was coming in an attempt, she claimed, to stop the murders continuing. Folger struggled free from Krenwinkel's grip and ran out to the side door to the pool area. Krenwinkel chased her, running Folger down on the front lawn, stabbing her a total of 28 times in a vicious frenzy. As Krenwinkel stabbed and ran the knife into Abigail Folger's body, Folger looked Krenwinkel dead in the eye and muttered, "I'm already dead." Watson then helped finish Folger off. Frykowski, still alive, albeit barely, slowly struggled across the lawn, but Watson jumped over his body, murdering him with a final blitz of stabbing. Frykowski suffered 51 stab wounds and had been struck 13 times in the head with Watson's handgun. The force was such that it bent the barrel of the gun and broke off one side of the gun's grip. Tate was by now hysterical and crying for her life and for the life of her unborn baby. She pleaded to be allowed to live long enough to give birth. She even offered herself as a hostage in an attempt to save the life of her child. Susan Atkins callously looked deadpan at Tate and said, "Woman, I have no mercy for you." Both Atkins and Watson then murdered Tate by stabbing her a total of 16 times. Over the years since the murders, both Atkins and Watson have claimed to have been the sole killer of Tate and also to have jointly committed the act. The evidence, however, suggests that the act was carried out with them both playing a part. Earlier that evening, as the killers were leaving to commit the murders, Charles Manson leaned into their car as they were pulling out of Spahn Ranch and told the women to leave a sign, leave something witchy. Adhering to this request, Atkins wrote "pig" on the front door of the house in Tate's blood. The killers then jumped back in their vehicle and headed back to Spahn Ranch, taking a route down Beverly Glen Boulevard. Passing Mama Cass's house, now owned by Ghostbusters actor Dan Aykroyd, and past an empty lot which now contains a house owned by Lady Gaga. Beverly Glen Boulevard ran along the top of Benedict Canyon. Now it's packed with properties and houses, but back in 1969, there was considerably less development having taken place in the canyon. This is why either Tex Watson or Linda Kasabian, it's unclear which, as both claim to have done so, threw the handgun used in the murders out of the car window. They assumed that the gun would land on an embankment and never be found. What they didn't realise, as you couldn't see from the road, was that the place where they threw the gun out of the car was directly above a row of houses. The gun would land specifically in the rear garden of the Weiss residence and would be found almost a month later on September the 1st by 11-year-old Stephen Weiss, who showed his father, Bernard Weiss, who, in turn, handed the weapon to the Van Nuys Division of the LAPD. Those of you who are fans, or at least will have seen the 1976 movie about the murders, may notice that Steve and Bernard Weiss had their names changed in the film to Stephen and Bernard Quint. They also made Stephen a few years younger than he actually was. Some movie trivia for you there. Just hopping back for a moment, you may remember that I said earlier that at Tate Cielo Drive property, there was a guest house to the rear where caretaker William Garretson resided. So let's talk about William Garretson for a minute or two, shall we? Garretson was a 19-year-old teenager from Ohio. He was hired by Rudy Altobelli, the owner of 1050 Cielo Drive, to be the caretaker of the tenants Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. William Garretson was listening to his stereo in the guest house when the murders took place. Just after midnight, he heard noises, but he was not sure if it was owner Hollywood agent Rudy Altobelli's dogs or their friends from the neighborhood. He turned off the lights and put on headphones. It probably saved his life. Tex sent Linda Kasabian to check the guest house, and she was gone a couple of minutes, but came back and said no one was there. She lied. She'd only been a half-hearted Manson family member to start with, and she intended to take no part in that night's events. Garretson went on police record to say that he recalls someone trying the door to his living quarters, but was scared so didn't investigate who it was. A strange claim if he was unaware of the night's events, but we'll come back to that. It's worth mentioning that the caretaker's house was on the other side of the pool to the main house, so Garretson was within 50 yards of the massacre itself. To take a quote from the police reports, it says in part, "In the opinion of the investigating officers and by the SID, it is highly likely that Garretson was not aware of the screams, gunshots, or other turmoil. These findings, however, did not absolutely preclude the fact that Garretson did not hear or see any of the events connected with the homicide. It is the investigator's opinion that Garretson was under the residual effects of some type of narcotic during the entire time he was in police custody. It's possible, but not probable, that Garretson had no real knowledge of the crime." Police Lieutenant Burdick came to the conclusion that Garretson was innocent of the actual murders, but may have been hiding something. Hollywood talent agent Rudy Altobelli was an openly gay man. Police connected to the investigation speculated that homeless, penniless teenager William Garretson got his job because he was willing to and in fact had sex with the homeowner, Altobelli. Altobelli would later admit that he liked Garretson and that his guard dogs liked the teen too. Any caretaker would have to take care of Altobelli's prize dogs too, so that was a prerequisite. During a polygraph of Garretson, administered by Detective Burdick, he asked about Stephen Parent dropping in that night. Detective Burdick asked, "Question, and he surprised you?" Answer, "Well, he didn't surprise me that he came, just that, you know, I mean, he came to visit me and then he left, you know, that's horrible." The two facts that came out of the interrogation, which helped win William Garretson his freedom, was that he was lonely and had no car. The house was miles from the nearest store and entertainment. The maid would take a list of groceries he wanted for when she went shopping for Sharon and her guests. Whatever the reason for Stephen's visit, our little company would be a welcome blessing for the boy. Lieutenant Burdick had heard that Altobelli was gay, so he asked Garretson, "Question, have you ever had sex with a man?" Answer, "Yes," Garretson answered. Then he asked him if he was gay, or whether he had ever had sex with any of the victims. Garretson replied with a firm no. Then Burdick asked, "Is there something right now that's on your mind that you don't want to disclose?" Garretson replies, "All I can say is I was really afraid that night." Burdick returned, "I wanted to sit here and think for a minute. Looks like there's something you're holding back. Whether it's about Steve or looking in that window, or what it is, I don't know." Later in the interrogation, it turned out William blamed himself for Parent's death. As he said, if he hadn't gotten a lift from Stephen, Stephen would never have been there that night. An addendum in the final police report stated, "Stephen Earl Parent, male Caucasian, 18 years old, 6 foot, 175 pounds, red hair, brown eyes. He lived with his parents at 11214 East Bryant Road, El Monte. His main occupation was that of a delivery boy for Valley City Plumbing Supply Company in Rosemead, California. He also worked part-time at night for Jones Miller Stereo at 8719 Wilshire Boulevard. On Friday morning, 8th of the 8th, 69, he told his mother to have a clean change of clothes ready for him for when he came home for lunch from his job at the plumbing supply company. He told her he was going back at his second job and didn't want to come home after work before going to Hollywood for his second job. Parent has an arrest record as a juvenile at age 14 years old for burglary and electric equipment. He served time in the California Youth Authority program. He was described as having homosexual tendencies by a psychologist probation officer. Keep in mind this was 1969 and homosexuality was still illegal. It wasn't decriminalized in California until 1976. It should also be noted at this point that Stephen Parent's juvenile records show that he turned his life around and hadn't been in any trouble since his arrest for burglary as a juvenile. He was a poor kid from a lower middle class neighborhood, blessed with a brilliant mind. Electronics fascinated him, but his family's limited means and school, which offered no opportunity for him to explore his field of interest, sidetracked him. When his case was resolved, adults intervened and got Stephen a job in the field of electronics and introduced him to teachers in the field. From that point on, Stephen made good grades in school and was set to enter college a few days after his untimely end. He was working two jobs and both employers not only liked him, they also said he was the best employee they had, a good kid who had his life stolen from him far too early. Steve's juvenile record probably explains the investigation being sidetracked on the Parent Garrison angle for a few days, which allowed Charles Manson to proceed with the insane criminal plan with impunity, as the LaBianca family would soon discover. Under interrogation, Garrison said he learned nothing of the murders until the following day when police officers showed up at the clubhouse. "The police officer pointed a gun at me, and I said, 'What's going on?' And he said, 'Shut up, I'll show you,'" Garrison recalls. Garrison said the police showed him part of the murder scene before he was arrested and questioned. They played a lot of head games and did the whole good cop, bad cop thing, and also did a polygraph, Garrison said. "I was placed in a cell with a bunch of people and I remember thinking, how the hell am I still alive?" Garrison testified that the dog started to bark after Stephen left at around 12:15 a.m. The lights were low and he was listening to the Doors and the Mamas and the Papas on the stereo through his headphones. Garrison said he heard a noise and saw the doorknob being rattled. It frightened him, and he remained quiet, which fits with what Linda Kasabian's testimony said. Garrison was exonerated when police determined that the double homicide of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca was by the same killers a few days later. The LaBiancas lived in a house formerly owned by Walt Disney when he first moved to California from Missouri in 1924 at 3311 Waverly Drive, Los Angeles. More on that next. The official timeline events surrounding Garrison and Parent were that Parent had called Garrison around 10 p.m. stating that he was in the neighborhood and could drop by. Garrison said yes and Parent arrived between 11:30 and 11:45 p.m. The two had some beers and Parent tried to sell a clock radio to Garrison, but he wasn't interested. Around 12:15, Parent left and was met by the murderers on the way out of the property. In later years, Garrison claimed he had heard gunshots, screams, and a woman saying, "I'm already dead," although it's possible and highly likely that his memory may have become tangled with the media's reporting of the events of that night. Garrison returned to his hometown of Lancaster, Ohio after his release from police custody, returning to Los Angeles only for the Manson trial. He never left his hometown after that, leading a quiet life, declining many lucrative interview offers throughout the years. He eventually died from cancer in 2016. To quote Michelle Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, who said, "After the murders, the rich and the famous in Hollywood lived at best in an enduring state of anxiety and at worst in a state of paranoia." Indeed, it is said that following the events at Cielo Drive, actor Steve McQueen was so scared that he started to carry a firearm with him at all times. So the Tate murders have taken place, and thus far the police have no leads, and there is still no clear reason why the Manson family committed the crime. But all will become clear in the next episode, when we start tying everything together. So we're going to leave this episode here for now. In part two, we're going to explain why these murders happened, a number of other murders linked to the Manson family, both before and after the Tate murders. the American trial of the century, and a lot more that ties everything together. We have barely scratched the surface tonight. Don't miss the conclusion of our Manson double bill on Saturday, September the 19th at midnight GMT. So until next time, stay safe everyone, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.